Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
My name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Katarzyna Czwirka about a book that she co-authored with Yasuhara Miho, Branding Japan's Food from Meibutsu to Washoku, which is out from the University of Hawaii Press 2020. The book explores historical and contemporary practices of place branding through food in Japan. The book's narrative centers on the event that precipitated its writing, namely the 2013 edition of Washoku, Traditional Dietary Cultures of the Japanese, notably for the celebration of New Year, to UNESCO's representative list of the Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity. And the authors argue that the definition of Washoku in the UNESCO nomination and the ultimate inscription is part of a much longer history of manipulative place branding in Japan that has its roots in the pre-modern period. Contemporary Japan's penchant for, and in fact success at, gastrodiplomacy is well known, but Czwirka and Yasuhara place this national-level soft power branding strategy within a centuries-long history of business practices that fabricated connections between products, many of them food products, and locations. These stories are told through the book's other two protagonists. So there's Washoku, there's also Meibutsu, which are famous products associated with a particular region, and Omiyage, travel souvenirs, many of which are edible, especially these days. Meibutsu and Omiyage are central to the travel experience in contemporary Japan, and many of the fictional narratives associated with various edible souvenirs have become part of the national collective memory. Branding Japan's Food is in part a warning, then, about how quickly and effectively these branding strategies, especially when associated with the pleasures of food and travel and national pride, can overwhelm historical realities. This, the authors argue, is not just a pedantic matter for academics, but a question about the value of culture and heritage. All right, Dr. Czwirka, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book. And I know that your co-author wasn't able to be here, but it's lovely to have you here. Can you tell us how you came to be interested in this project in particular?
Oh, first of all, thank you for having me. And please call me by my first name because, you know, my surname is impossible to pronounce. So
will do. Thank you.
I wasn't interested in the project at all to begin with. I was actually kind of irritated by the fact that Washoku was inscribed as UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage. And actually, me and my co-author, we were often calling each other via Skype and complaining about all kinds of misconceptions that were visible in the media, and not only the media, but also the lack of any critical voice among our colleagues in Japan. And then after complaining about it for a couple of months, we decided, well, wait a second, we can do something about it. And then we decided, okay, let's jump into it. So it was out of necessity rather than interest that we began researching the first of the three protagonists in the book, the Washoku, and its inscription on the UNESCO intangible cultural heritage list.
Right. And yeah, that's interesting. I think your irritation shows through, it shines through in the book. And I certainly share it.
It doesn't shine too much.
Well, no, but I think it's one of the things that attracted me to the book, because of course I was, you know, here in Japan when the World Heritage inscription happened, right after it happened, and was certainly consuming enough Japanese media at the time to think that the Japanese media reports about, look, there are, you know, white people in London eating ramen, washoku is wonderful, was not exactly the spirit of what UNESCO was talking about. So the sort of lack of critical voices, not just, you know, of course, in academia, but out in the wider world, was something I had noticed as well. So that actually takes us directly into your sort of into the introduction of the book, which is that in December 2013, washoku, which is described as traditional dietary cultures of the Japanese, notably for the celebration of New Year, was recognized by UNESCO as part of the intangible cultural heritage. And so your book argues that washoku, as it's defined in the government dossier, and then ultimately in the World Heritage, and I'm quoting you here, is a modern construct that reveals more about Japan's 20th century transformations than about age-old culinary traditions. And you see the World Heritage nomination and Japanese framing of washoku primarily as a historical, manipulative, soft power gaming, trafficking in, I guess, what you might call alternative facts in the world we live in. And you situate this sort of modern gastro diplomacy in a long tradition of place branding in Japan, which you elaborate on in the individual chapters, and I know we'll talk about. But can you tell me in a little bit more detail before we jump into that, what exactly about the definition of washoku bothered you and why it's problematic?
Well, there are several problems. The definition is problematic from many angles, and to begin with, it is entirely incomprehensible. This is the reason why we actually include the whole nomination in our book as an appendix. And what I usually do when I do a seminar, I have a Japanese food seminar here at Leiden University, and one of the sessions is on washoku. And what I usually do is I distribute the first few pages of the UNESCO nomination to the students and ask them to read it, and then ask a very simple question. Well, tell me what washoku is. And it is a very interesting exercise, because it's just impossible to say what it is. It's the first problem with the definition provided by the government is that it's just kind of collection of all kinds of cliches that translated from Japanese into English, and then it is incomprehensible. So this is the first problem. The second problem that you already mentioned is that it's ahistorical. So we've tried to explain in the book why basically several issues that are being highlighted in the definition actually contradict historical facts entirely. And another problem is that it is also very arbitrary. So what I mean by that, it contradicts all the definitions that one can find. There aren't many, many to be honest. There is, washoku has not actually been really defined before 2013. There was no need for it. But whatever we find in dictionaries and encyclopedias has no resemblance whatsoever to the definition that the UNESCO nomination is providing. So, for example, in the one of the first, the very first entry of washoku in the Japanese language dictionary from 1981, surprisingly recent, it is simply explained as a Japanese style meal. So there is no mention of any social practice and other mumbo jumbo that we find in the UNESCO nomination. I could go on forever, of course, about this. So maybe it's the best time to stop here. Or
right. No, I think that it highlights, well, first of all, as you say, you could go on forever. There are so many issues, but also the fact that it is both a historical and what I think we refer to in Japanese as kasumigaseki bungaku, the sort of bureaucraties, I guess, in English, it doesn't really, you know, hold together and make sense in a lot of ways. And when you try and pick it apart, as you do in much of the remainder of the book, in sort of, you know, looking at the history of how it comes to be what it is, it does not hold together. But in the actual chapters, it's not the first thing that you look at, because chapter one is called One Soup and Three Dishes, and that's the prototypical or stereotypical contemporary Japanese meal pattern of Ichiju Sansai, or one soup and three dishes, right? And that's rice being the assumed center, the empty center, I guess, since it's not mentioned. And you show that, like washoku, this is also a modern construct, and you point out a variety of factors like wartime rice rationing, post-war policy, media, etc., in making this the ideal, the normative meal plan. And I thought it was interesting that you also point out the continuing influence of the government's food education or shokuiku campaigns. So can you tell us about how Ichiju Sansai comes to have this central role in the culinary mythology of contemporary Japan, and then how this relates to the branding of Japanese food at home and on the world stage in washoku and in other sort of aspects?
Well, before I answer this question, let me add maybe one piece of information that might be relevant for the readers.
Sure.
Is that me and my co-author, we became frustrated in 2014, and when we decided, okay, let's do something about it. And then in 2016, we published the Japanese version of the book, which was basically laying out all the inconsistencies and trying to correct the picture that was presented by the media. And that was it was an important book, but it was written in Japanese. It was published for the Japanese market, for the people who have a profound, kind of thorough knowledge of what Japanese food is. And the challenge in writing the English version of the book was that we didn't want it to be a kind of repetitive picking on why the UNESCO nomination is wrong, but actually also provide the reader who might not be familiar with Japanese cuisine with all kinds of important information that will kind of correct provide the more or less correct picture of the modern Japanese food history. So this is why we kind of provide all kinds of information that we didn't in the Japanese version. And for example, the question that you ask now, Ichiju Sansai, it doesn't, or the one soup and three side dishes structure of the Japanese meal, it doesn't need any explanation for the Japanese reader, because it has become, through the, as you mentioned, through the shokuiku education, it has become a kind of internalized. Yes, our Japanese meal consists of one soup, three side dishes, and rice. And everybody assumes that this is the kind of historical continuity in this structure. But actually, when we started looking into records of meals in historical context, we have found that it was the Ichiju Issai, so one soup and one dish, one side dish, or sometimes even one soup or one side dish, that was the norm in the daily diet. And we give this several examples from different historical periods, indicating that whilst having more side dishes, of course, was always welcome. But on the daily basis, the Japanese population, even the people from the affluent households, actually did not eat that many side dishes as three. So this is already one inconsistency that has already, it's actually kind of damaging effect of Shokuiku campaign that kind of projects the present into the past. So people, so there is this view of what Japanese ate in the past is completely distorted. I don't know if you get my point.
Yeah, that's I you know, as you know, I also am, I'm in, you know, researching in this field, and that idea of ichiju isai, of the one side dish, is something that I sort of keep coming across as well. So it was sort of interesting to see it brought out here as the corrective to the whole rhetoric about, you know, three side dishes being the norm. And I think your point that the contemporary food education campaigns, and I think, you know, to a larger extent, the you know, popular press and media really have this presentist idea that, you know, Japanese have always eaten in a certain way. It is a very strange historical distortion, especially because, you know, as you, you know, point out in part in the book, I think the what you're really talking about is, you know, especially with white rice as the centerpiece, you know, a tremendously luxurious meal by historical standards.
Yeah. So, but the point is that very the history of rice, right? We have the Onoki Tierney's book from the 1990s, even where the kind of myth of rice eating Japanese has already been debunked to a certain extent. So it's already there is a literature, rich literature on the rice issue, but I haven't found much. We haven't found much information about Ichiju Sansai and how it has, how it relates to the real food that people ate. So, for example, what is also interesting, we haven't really explored it in the book, but this is something that I often do in my seminars. As you are probably familiar, the Japanese used a shared table only since the 1920s. So the table where people sit around, more than one person sits around and shares a table. So the 1920s, we see the so-called chabudai, the table with low legs, kind of becoming popular. And then from the 1970s, the our Western style table with long legs. But before the 1920s, people used so-called hakozen, or there were different variations of those tables depending on the location. But basically, these were like individual trays that each person used alone. But when you look at the sizes of those trays, it becomes immediately clear that there was no space for any more than three dishes. So it would be soup and rice and soup, or some other grain and soup, or maybe a small plate with a side dish. But there was absolutely no room for more. So this is one additional example that I usually give in my seminars, just kind of evidence that this was the mainstream.
That's quite striking, and I guess it's unfortunate that generally I don't think so, but I think at this point it's unfortunate that the podcast is not a visual medium. I would encourage our listeners to look up what a hakozen looks like, because it will, as Kasha, as you said, be immediately clear that they're quite small. The amount of space that you actually have to set out a meal, and since they're all individual, that gives you a pretty good idea of what each person was eating. That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about that. So when you lay out that historicization, I guess, of the, I guess you'd call it a standard Japanese diet, or at least idealized standard Japanese diet, in your first chapter. And then in the second chapter, you get into the question of washoku that we had talked about related to the introduction. As you point out, and I'm just, if you'll permit me to quote you here, in the nomination file submitted by the Japanese government, washoku is defined as, and here we have one of these, that this long gobbledygook that you were complaining about. So let me read it. In part, it reads, a social practice based on a comprehensive set of skills, knowledge, practice, and traditions related to the production, processing, preparation, and consumption of food. It is associated with an essential spirit of respect for nature, closely related to the sustainable use of natural resources. However, in this chapter, you show that the definition basically runs contrary to the historical usage, as you've said, that retail and that department stores in particular were largely responsible for the adoption of this word washoku in common parlance, and also that the word was basically used synonymously or with, you know, very significant overlap with other terms prior to the kind of revolution in 2012 that the UNESCO nomination gave us. So what did the word washoku mean before the submission of the dossier, and what other terms is it intersecting with? And I'm also curious, I think the audience would appreciate hearing a little bit about the methodology in this chapter and how you, what sources you use to reach these conclusions.
Well, this was actually a very the first thing we actually started investigating. This chapter was in itself a fascinating journey. So when we decided to write the book, the first thing you actually always do, right, when you do research, is you look at the word washoku and then try to find the etymological roots and the use. And fortunately for us, we now have the lots of data available through databases online. So we were fortunate enough to be able to look into the records of two daily newspapers, Asahi Shimbun, Yomiuri Shimbun, and we were able to look into, there is the full search until the 1980s, and then there is keywords that you can use to search further. So we did that. It was a hell of a job, but very fascinating. So and the reason why it was fascinating then was actually we had no idea what the sources would show us. So we found, for example, the very first mention of the earliest appearance of washoku in the Asahi Shimbun was in 1892. And in Yomiuri Shimbun was in 1907. And what struck us was striking that in both cases, and this is actually a tendency that continued, the use of word washoku in those articles was paired with another word, yoshoku, which means Western food. And this is a tendency that continued throughout the decades. And I felt like yoshoku is kind of haunting me, because I actually, more than 20 years ago, I was I did my PhD research on precisely the topic. So I was, and it actually struck me that when I was doing my PhD dissertation that eventually was published into the book in 2006, the Modern Japanese Cuisine, that I was actually interested so much in yoshoku that I took washoku for granted. I actually never, wrong attitude probably, that I never actually investigated washoku as a term then. But now all this old knowledge came back, and it was quite clear, and it actually quite logical that the word washoku actually emerged along with other neologisms at the time to kind of demarcate the Japanese style material objects, and including food, as opposed to Western style food. Or, you know, we have words such as wafu, that means Western style. And these words are all new. They are kind of created in the late 19th century. And then it's fascinating to see how these words, and we concentrated, of course, on washoku, how it actually kind of evolved over in the course of the 20th century. So, for example, in the early 20th century, it is used almost the same way as another term that emerges in the late 19th century, which is Nihon Ryori, or which also means Japanese food. So they are used interchangeably, and then gradually it shifts. And what is interesting, and here the whole conversation becomes complicated, because one of the aspects of the nomination, UNESCO nomination, that we haven't talked yet, is that washoku is presented in the nomination as a kind of cultural heritage that is owned by all Japanese. And if it's owned by all Japanese, that means that washoku is in principle the food cooked at home. But when we start looking at the use and the meaning of the word in the course of the 20th century, it never actually was used in the sense of home cooked meal. I'm not sure if you want me to continue, or shall we?
By all means, I think this sort of problem of, you know, not only the genesis amnesia of sort of forgetting that it, you know, it's a modern neologism, but also the fact that it's decontextualized is one of the fascinating things that you lay out in this chapter. So, if you'd like to continue, please go ahead.
So, for example, apart from the newspapers, we also looked at cookbooks, restaurant guides, etiquette manuals. And what was interesting is that, for example, nowadays, when we look into the dictionaries, that Nihon Ryori would be a term reserved more for restaurant cuisine, while washoku would be, it is not specified as such, but would be more, people would be more inclined to connect it with home cooking, and Nihon Ryori would be a kind of a restaurant cuisine. But this is not the case at all in the past. So, for example, in cookbooks, in my previous research, I did research on how the Japanese home cookery was created, and of course, cookbooks targeted at middle class housewives were an important component of this whole process of construction of Japanese home cookery. So in those cookbooks, the term Nihon Ryori is used much more often than washoku. Washoku almost never appears. While in etiquette manuals, where people, when advice is given on eating basically restaurant cuisine, the word washoku is prevalent. So we have a completely different kind of use of the word than we use today. And of course, the fact that we actually argue that the word washoku came into common use since the 1930s through the channel of department store restaurants. Again, here, washoku is also a restaurant meal rather than anything related to home cooking. So, the home cooking connotation with washoku is, of course, related to the whole process of UNESCO nomination, what kind of requirements the nominations have to meet which is an entirely different story, maybe for another podcast. But
sure.
But so we see that the nomination is actually created, this connection with home cooking is created by the government in order to meet the requirements of the UNESCO screening rather than to reflect the historical understanding of Japanese cuisine and in particular the washoku category.
Right. So if I'm reading it correctly, I mean your contention is less that the language changed, because language changes, but that it was changed in a very specific way to meet a very specific goal. And that sort of forcible ahistoricization of the word is the problematic part of it, because if you're claiming that it's cultural heritage and yet you're ripping it out of its cultural and historical context, that I think this seemed to me to be the source of your frustration. Am I reading that right?
One of many sources of frustration.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. But never let it be said that you had only one thing to be frustrated about, right? Because in fact, you actually have three protagonists as well, and multiple things to be annoyed about, and also multiple things to write about. And I want to jump into chapter three, in which you introduce the second of your three protagonists. This is Meibutsu. So the chapter title is Meibutsu and Commercialized Travel in Early Modern Japan. So first you'll have to tell us what were meibutsu, obviously, but you conclude here, I suspect with tongue-in-cheek, that the fabricating imaginary connections with history has been the bread and butter of Japanese commercial culture for centuries. I think this is the way that I've been telling people that modern monetary theory is the gold standard recently. Some people don't seem to get the irony. But anyway, so can you tell us what were meibutsu? How did they function within early modern Japan? What's their connection to travel? And why is that important to understanding the food culture? And this big theme that you have here of place branding, which is, you know, the thing that sort of ties these all together in the Tokugawa period, in the pre-modern period. And also how these... how what you're describing as imaginary historical connections were created and then used to brand foods.
Yes, actually, meibutsu and the meibutsu and omiyage part was actually not a source of frustration for me. It was just wonderful to be able to find an answer to the question that we ask ourselves. When we were after the Japanese version of the book was published in 2016, we were obviously looking for ways to write an English version of the book, and it became immediately obvious that translation was not an option, so that it had to be a completely different book. But there were several challenges. One was that, of course, we're not writing for the Japanese audience, and lots of issues and historical connections had to be explained. But there was another very important question that we didn't answer in the Japanese version that we wanted to actually write in to address in the English language version of the book was, okay, why there is no critical response to the washoku manipulation, let's call it that way, from the Japanese public, from the Japanese media, from the Japanese scholarly community. So actually we found the answer to this question through meibutsu, and that's why it was very rewarding rather than frustrating. So
I stand corrected.
In a way, we are all, as Japan studies people, are we all aware of meibutsu and omiyage, and it's kind of taken for granted Japanese folklore that we kind of traditions that we or the customs that we kind of internalize. But I actually never really thought about it until I was actually when we started doing the working on the English version of the book, I was already kind of in the middle of my new project, which is the food packaging. And I was looking at the packaging of Omiyage. I know I'm jumping ahead, so maybe I should just explain the words first.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
The chapter 3 and 4 are dealing with two words that are often conflated. So we have meibutsu, which is the easiest way to translate it would be like a famous product, but it's actually kind of iconic product of a particular place. And very often it is used interchangeably with the word omiyage, which is a kind of the souvenir from a trip, which is basically a meibutsu. So meibutsu, let's stick to the culinary meibutsu. So culinary meibutsu would be something that is particularly kind of iconic representation of a specific place. And at the moment when you take your meibutsu and give it to somebody else, it becomes omiyage. I'm not sure. Is this kind of clear, this distinction?
Well, it's clear to me, but yeah. So I think that's a very fair point, right? That you have these special local products, and then many of them, as you point out in the book, are culinary meibutsu. They become representative of the region, and therefore, for that and some other reasons, which you delineate in the book, they become sort of the among the most often preferred souvenirs when people go to those places, and so they become associated with the places. I think that's fairly clear. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is interesting is that very often those because those products are representative of a particular place, they usually in one way or another connected with the area. So one of the most famous and often, well, not always most famous, but the oldest meibutsu would be the ones that have been around for several centuries, and they were mentioned in all kinds of historical guidebooks of the area and so forth. So I assumed that, okay, if this has been mentioned in one of those regional guidebooks from the 18th century, it must be real, right? But when you start digging into the kind of trajectory, how this particular meibutsu emerged, it turns out that they were branded products. And there is a wonderfully rich literature, primarily by the scholars of pre-modern Japan, but primarily art historians, on the history of travel and travel related travel literature and travel related prints and so forth, that gives us a very clear picture how these connections between travel and local products were actually kind of manipulated for commercial purpose. The fact that this happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, doesn't make it less imagined or constructed. It just happened earlier.
Right. So this is your sort of one of your examples of the sort of fictionalized, imaginary historical connections or sort of place connections or, you know, general sort of narratives around different types of in the case of the book, I mean, mostly food, of course, but that then get associated with a place and become part of that place branding historically. And you've already begun to touch on the third protagonist, which is the omiyage. You know, and as you say, the word basically means souvenir in the way we use it today. In chapter four, omiyage, how to concoct a local flavor. You point out, though, that the word has a history and cultural significance beyond beyond just the idea of a souvenir. And you do talk about how omiyage are most often foods in contemporary Japan, and you link the edible omiyage to the modern socio-political and economic system, I'm quoting you here, that began to develop at the end of the 19th century. And the very first step in this process was the introduction of the railroad. So you look at the influence of empire, war, the packaging industry, and a number of other things. And you place a lot of emphasis on the 60s and 70s in the development of the sort of regime of omiyage in contemporary Japan. And so can you tell us how they sort of emerge historically and how they fit into the larger constellation of place branding in Japan, especially the sort of factually dubious ones that you're interested in?
Well, actually, I must correct you here. It's
okay.
Place branding in Japan is overwhelmingly dubious. so it's not only that some of them. It's just completely. I'm not sure if dubious means imagined.
I will cede to the author on this one. You can
So the starting point for this chapter was for me. A wonderful book by Suzuki Yuichiro, Omiyage to Tetsudo, Meibutsu de Kataru Nihon Kindaishi, which I was reading for my other project, the packaging project. And because in the food packaging project, omiyage play an important role, obviously I was reading this book. And then Suzuki, like, this book just opened my eyes, said, of course, the omiyage and the train connection, right? So when we think about pre-modern travel and people traveling mainly on foot, and we compare it with today when people, when people go on a trip and come back, well, nowadays they are probably, they would even have the omiyage sent by Takubin or other services. But anyway, people coming back with lots of boxes for the friends and, the co-workers and neighbors and family and so forth. When you compare this with pre-modern times, when they had to walk and would actually have to carry this omiyage on their back, it becomes completely obvious. Of course, this is the case that the introduction of railway and the kind of replacing the railway replacing the normal mode of travel, which would be on foot, it has tremendous impact on the type of omiyage that people would bring home. So omiyage is I'm not going to do a whole lecture on omiyage. Omiyage isn't a concept that has been treated by it received good treatment in the literature. Lots of studies have been done on that. But this kind of switch into food, I think that Suzuki is one of the first scholars who actually kind of specifically points out to the fact that the introduction of the railway made it possible, first of all, for people to bring more like bulky omiyage souvenirs, and secondly, to bring food that is perishable. And for example, in his book, he gives this wonderful example of Yatsuhashi, which is the Kyoto omiyage. And there are actually two different types of Yatsuhashi, the fresh Yatsuhashi, Nama Yatsuhashi, and the baked ones. And actually the Nama Yatsuhashi becomes popular in the 1960s when Shinkansen is introduced, because otherwise they would go bad if people would need to travel with them for several hours.
Yeah, this is actually one of the things that I really liked about this chapter, the way that it's also a history of technology and the way that mobility transforms a society and changes our sense of place and space, and how specifically that sort of plays out in the way that place branding is occurring.
Yeah, well, the place branding, so the place branding is a kind of new concept, relatively new concept. There is a whole literature on it that I try to kind of at least scratch the surface of. And it seems that place branding becomes mainstream during the 1990s around the world. Place branding is something that is basically kind of occupying practically every municipal government around the world. But it seems to me that place branding in Japan occurs already quite early. And maybe if I have done a very thorough study of whatever other place, or Italy or the other societies, maybe I would find more historical connections. But when we stick to Japan, it's quite amazing to see that basically the same or similar strategies are being employed in place branding today as they were 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's sort of the precociousness of Japanese place branding is one of the things that really comes out in these two chapters on Meibutsu and Omiyage. So in the final chapter, you return to the theme of washoku. And so I want to take us back to where we started with that, because in the final chapter, you argue that the core of washoku branding relies on misleading the public into confusing it with kaiseki, or as you say, dressing a wolf in sheep's clothing, which is the chapter title. So first, can you tell our audience what kaiseki is? And to sort of riff on this metaphor of the wolf in sheep's clothing, how did the Japanese government pull the wool over UNESCO's eyes, not to mention the public at home and abroad, right? Because it doesn't really, I have to admit, I found it hard to understand when washoku became part of the World Heritage, how UNESCO had been convinced to accept this. I had actually done a little bit of work with World Heritage in Japan as a translator, translating actual World Heritage dossiers in the past. So I have some sense of how that process works. And I have to admit, this one amazed me. So if you could tell us a little bit about the sort of problem of it and what kaiseki is and sort of how that works, that'd be great.
Well, this is another huge topic to discuss. So as we discussed earlier, washoku has been presented in the nomination as the food of all Japanese that people cook at home. But when you start looking at maybe everybody can do it, just enter the Google and try to Google washoku within images, you will get all those images that will show you wonderfully, just kind of wonderful, mind-blowing Japanese cuisine that nobody could ever prepare at home. And this is kaiseki. Kaiseki is what we could very broadly define as Japanese art cuisine, and it has its history. And basically, there are two types of kaiseki. One is the tea ceremony meal, and the other one is restaurant kaiseki. But I won't get into that. But basically, kaiseki is a kind of a very refined restaurant food. And we see the influence of this refined art cuisine also trickling down to less expensive restaurants in the way food is presented. But basically, kaiseki is not, maybe there are some people who might try to cook kaiseki at home, but I would say that there would be, basically kaiseki is a professional cookery area. But what the reason I'm using the wolf in sheep's clothing metaphor here is that while Washoku nomination that the Japanese government was presented to UNESCO was talking about the home food that the Japanese cook, after they received the UNESCO approval, they started promoting kaiseki under the name of Washoku, which as a food historian, I find just appalling. I'm just amazed how a government that is supposed to protect, you know, the culture of its society is doing something like that.
Yeah, the sleight of hand is quite amazing. I will say though, if anybody would like to, you know, come to my home and cook kaiseki for me, they're certainly welcome to. But I agree with you. I mean, it is really something that you don't see in the home, and the sudden transformation of, you know, kaiseki into washoku and washoku into kaiseki was quite astonishing. Yeah. So I want to just sort of, in closing the interview here about the book, play devil's advocate just for a minute. And touch on something that you get at in this final chapter. So you characterize, you talk about the manipulative branding of kaiseki as washoku, which is what we've been talking about. So the bogus representation of kaiseki as washoku, right? It's consciously orchestrated from above. I think that I agree with you. But let me play devil's advocate and say, okay, so what? I mean, they're myths. They're the just-so stories of Kipling, and you know, same with, you know, Meibutsu and Omiyage, these sort of fictional connections that are made. Are they doing any particular lasting harm to someone? Are they, you know, I mean, they seem like sort of harmless, feel-good narratives, right? And they grease the wheels of the economy and everybody's happy. So what's the problem?
Well, maybe let me ask you a question that is actually kind of similar. Mm-hmm. If you would have, let's say, two pictures, one is by Rembrandt, another is, I'm just taking my Dutch connections here. We have a picture by Rembrandt and we have a picture by Van Gogh. Well, okay, what doesn't matter which one is which. We're all happy, they're beautiful, and it doesn't matter what is, you know, what is the label. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm kind of exaggerating here, but basically this is what is happening. And the fact that this is food and we tend to be a little bit more lenient in terms of kind of treating food as a kind of full-fledged, legitimate cultural expression, this seems much less harmful, but I think it is. And I'll give you one example. For example, if you go to any online databases with Japanese dictionaries and you you enter the search term washoku, several online dictionaries, Japanese dictionaries, the Japanese language dictionaries and even the English language dictionaries will show you the UNESCO definition what washoku is. And this was not the case before 2013. You wouldn't get this misleading definition in the dictionary. So this is why I find it so important to talk about washoku in my seminars, because not because I work on it, but it is so important to correct this, especially for Japan studies students who think that it's kind of cool that Washoku is this is the kind of attitude that Japanese people have, and also the Japan study students, they would say, oh, it's cool, it's UNESCO heritage, but they don't realize how much of it it's actually kind of manipulation. And I think it's important, especially when we talk about historical understanding of culinary culture, to just make sure that this kind of manipulation is understood.
Yeah, well, that's exceptionally well said, and I've certainly learned my lesson. I won't play devil's advocate with you again. Here at the end of the interview, we always ask our guests about what they're up to now. And I know that you said that, you know, since doing this book, you've been involved in the packaging project. But I'm curious what it is that you have on the horizon for us.
Well, this book, as all books, have again been delayed, but I've been working on the history of food packaging in Japan. And this is, again, I don't know if this is the same for everybody, but I kind of keep coming back to my PhD research when I worked on the history of Yoshoku, Western style food in Japan. I didn't realize that at the time, but I made use of packaging to argue my case. And this is, of course, very understandable, because food is ephemeral, so it disappears. So if you do historical research on food, it's usually the cookbooks and other resources, but also packaging is an important source to study historical connections. And then I have never follow up on this, and basically what I'm working on now is to the kind of development of food packaging in Japan, and the main question I'm trying to answer is, why are the Japanese so obsessed with packaging these days?
Okay, well, that sounds fascinating, and I hope that we will get to see the book soon, and that when it comes out, you will consider coming back on the podcast with us. For now, I just wanted to thank you for being so generous with your time to join us today on the podcast.
Thank you.